We were fortunate to have Colm Tobin write a short story for our exhibition catalog, which is available for purchase. It's a short story entitled Audition, and Colm is going to read that a little section for us. Colm Tobin is an acclaimed Irish novelist, short story writer, essayist, playwright, critic, and poet. He is the author of 9 novels, including The South, winner of the Irish Times Literature Prize in 1991, The Heather Blazing, winner of the Encore Award for the Best Second Novel in 1992, The Blackwater Lightship, shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, The Master, shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, and winner of the Los Angeles Times Novel of the Year, and Brooklyn, winner of the Costa Book Award. He's a regular contributor to the London Review of Books and the New York Review of Books, and has written several books of nonfiction. In 2012, his latest collection of essays, New Ways to Kill Your Mother, Writers and Their Families, was published, as well as the novel, The Testament of Mary, which was longlisted for the 2013 Man Booker Prize. So we welcome Colm to you.
I just want to say first that Sean Scully has been a terribly important figure in contemporary Ireland, not only, I think, for artists, but for the actual people of the country. That in that great gallery in the middle of Dublin, the gallery that Yeats fought to build, that Lady Gregory's nephew, Hugh Lane, fought to have, that Lady Gregory herself fought for, the Municipal Gallery or the Hugh Lane Municipal Gallery, that his work there is, I suppose what I'm talking about is a sense for people of something spiritual, something that is deep within the society and perhaps hidden within the society now, but that emerges in that work despite the fact that you don't see that as obvious the first time, just simply the more you look. And I know numbers of people who simply go there regularly for comfort, for something from those paintings, and it's made a very big difference to us. The fact that Sean Scully exhibits in the Curlin Gallery in Dublin, and that he is regularly in Ireland, and that his... So just want to begin by saying, when I came to look at this work, please, just anyone, if you haven't looked for a very long time, just come back tomorrow, and just the longer you look, the more the paintings or the drawings or whatever the colours will yield. And I was working hard, I was working with words, and they just, the more I stopped thinking, and the more I started looking, and the more I just looked and looked, the more I went away with, and the more it hit my nervous system. And so I wrote this. Nora Webster, it's the late 1960s, it's the town of Enniscorthy in the southeast of Ireland. Her husband has died, and everyone thinks there's something she should do, or that there's some new life she should live. And one of her friends comes up with the idea that she should take singing lessons, and she doesn't want singing lessons. And then a woman offers to give her singing lessons. She doesn't want to be given singing lessons. But because she's in such a fragile state, she finds herself knocking on the door of the woman who's called Laurie O'Keefe for a singing lesson. When Billy opened the door to her, he immediately asked her in, holding back a Labrador dog by the collar. The hallway was wide and dark with old pictures on the wall. There was a smell of polish. Billy began to call downstairs for his wife, but as there was no reply, he shut the dog in the room on the left and began walking down the creaking staircase to the basement, motioning to Nora to remain in the hall. "She never hears me," he said, and seemed amused at the idea. While Nora waited, the dog began to bark. Soon Billy O'Keefe appeared again. "Come down," he said. "She says you are to come down." He led her down the narrow book-lined staircase and into a small tiled hallway, which had some coats hanging on a set of hooks. He opened a door in a bright space which had clearly been added to the back of the old house. Laurie O'Keefe stood up from the piano. "Now, Billy will make us tea unless you want coffee," she said, "and biscuits, Billy, the nice ones I bought." She smiled at him as he closed the door. "It's only a baby grand," she said, as though Nora had asked her about the piano. "And of course I have another one there, just a plain old upright for the students to bang on." There was no other furniture in the room except a few old chairs. There was a rug on the floor and sheet music strewn about. The walls were painted white with prints of abstract paintings hanging at different heights. "We'll have our tea in here," Laurie said. Laurie led her into another room, which had a sofa and easy chairs, a large stereo record player and speakers, and a large case from floor to ceiling of records. "No one has any pity for a woman married to a man who is tone deaf," Laurie said. "No one." Nora did not know what this meant, or if she was expected to reply. "You know, there is something we have been meaning to say to you," Laurie went on. "I almost wrote you a letter when we sent you the mask card, but then I thought, no, I'd say it to you when I saw you." They both sat down on the two armchairs. Nora looked out at the garden for a moment and then back at Laurie. "We were driving down from Dublin. We'd been away. Oh, cousins and nieces and all that. And then we were driving back into the town and it was such a lovely day and all the traffic was stopped. I don't know how long we were stopped in Blackstoops. We thought that there might have been an accident. It never struck us that it was a funeral. I don't know why. And eventually when I saw people walking, I pulled down the window and I asked someone what it was. Oh, we were very shocked when they told us. We knew Morris was sick, but we were very shocked. And Billy said how good Morris had been to his boys in school, and what a great teacher he was. And we thought that if we could do anything for you..." You're very kind," Nora said. And then Phyllis said, "I'm not sure my voice is up to much." "There is no better way to heal yourself than singing in a choir," Laurie said. "That is why God made music. You know, I had my own troubles. Coming out of a convent at 50 and hardly a friend in the world, and it was the choir that got me started again. That was the one thing I had, my voice and the piano. Although I trained first on the harpsichord, that was my first love." Billy came into the room with a tray. "And this," Laurie said, pointing at Billy, "I suppose will be my last love." "Do you mean me, Laurie?" he asked. "I do, but you can leave us now. We have things to talk about." Billy put his fingers to his lips and smiled at Nora and tiptoed out of the room. "You know, I sang for Nadia Boulanger," Laurie continued, "and one thing she said was that singing is not something you do, it is something you live. Wasn't that wise?" Nora nodded, doing nothing to indicate that she did not know who Nadia Boulanger was. She tried to remember the name so she could mention it to Phyllis, her friend, who might know. "But I do have to get a feel for your voice before we set to work. Can you read music?" "Yes, I can," Nora said. "Not well, but I learned years ago at school. It might be best to start with something you actually know." She went into the other room and came back with books of sheet music. "Drink your tea and look through these and pick one you are familiar with. I'll go into the other room and play the piano. I can't think what to play, but something I love, I know from memory. And maybe the sound will warm us up, and I don't have a pupil until 4, so there's plenty of time." Nora wondered what had caused her to be in this strange house with this strange woman who could not stop talking. If there was a door out of this room into the garden, she thought, she would be tempted to go now, slip out as the piano music began to play, and walk slowly down the garden path and into Wafer Street and along the back road to her own house and never go out again. She sipped the tea and put down the cup and rested her head against the back of the chair. The music Laurie was playing was too fast and cluttered, she thought. Whoever wrote it had put in too many notes. It was a virtuoso piece, and she realized that Laurie was showing off and felt almost sorry for her, that she would need to do this. It could hardly be what she did for relaxation. If Morris, who's her husband who's died, if Morris were alive now, she would delight in telling him what had happened. He would say how right Billy O'Keefe was to have earplugs so that he would not have to hear as his second wife, the former nun, pounded the piano. Imagine being married to a former nun who played the piano. She could hear Morris's dry tone and see the look of pure amusement on his face. She flicked through the books of sheet music. Most of them were German songs she'd never heard of, and wondered now if her friend had given Laurie the impression that she knew more than she did. When she came to a book of Irish songs, they seemed all too silly and old-fashioned and stage Irish, songs that no one sang anymore. At the bottom of a pile were a few single sheets with some of Moore's melodies. She looked at Believe Me for all those endearing young charms, but thought it was too stilted. Then she found the last rose of summer. She began studying the notes and humming the familiar tune when Laurie returned to the room. "You found something then?" Well, I found this." She handed her the sheet for the last rose of summer. "Yes, I had an old novice mistress from the Alsace, and I don't know where she learned the phrase, but she used to call me the last rose of summer, even if I was on time. Oh, she was an old battle axe, close to God, I suppose, but an old battle axe nonetheless." Laurie walked into the other room and sat at the piano. Nora followed her uneasily. "Now, this is very wrong," Laurie said, "and it's bad for your voice. We should do exercises to warm it up and not go straight into a song." "But there's something about you now that might not be there in a while. I saw it when you came in the door. You have... What? You've been close to the other side, haven't you?" What do you mean?" Don't talk now. Let me hear your voice. Let me go through the melody first." She played and then stopped. "I'm going to go down an octave and see where that takes us." Laurie played, concentrating on the music, slowing the melody down as she went along. "I think I have it now. We really shouldn't be doing this, but your voice might never be as good as it is today. Let me play for a while again, and then when I signal, you come in." So they do these lessons over a while, and as the training goes on, they just to speed things up a bit, when Nora left Laurie and the lesson was over, she felt free of her and looked forward to the 6 days ahead when she would not have to stand at the piano obeying orders. But then she starts to look forward to coming. And she returned, she was told to look again at the colours in the frame, because Laurie O'Keefe has shown her these colours. "These paintings have made their way, in my imagination, to Enniscorthy. And what Laurie is telling her to do is simply to look at them, simply to stop thinking, and simply, as she's singing, to look at the colours. She could not be sure about the colours. They were filled with shadow as much as colour. She looked at the shadow, studied the darker end of each of them, and then let her light move from right to left, following a line towards brightness or some beginning. Who did them?" she asked again. "Don't ask," Laurie said. "No colour was precise. She tried to look into each shade to see, but there did not appear to be enough light, even though the room itself was bright. What I want you to do now," Laurie said, "is sing, and only look at the colours when you sing. And don't think about the words or me or anything else. Make the sound from what you look at. Concentrate now." She played the introduction, so familiar to Nora, on the piano and left a moment before she signaled to her to begin. When Nora wondered why she was doing this, she lost her concentration and had to stop. "It's only sound you're making. That's all it is. Think of what's in the frame as a sort of sound. It's paint on paper. It's soaked into the paper as sound soaks into space. Don't worry, just look. Let the colours guide you. Clear your mind of everything else." When Nora returned to Laurie, she was told to look again at the colours in the frame and try to imagine them coming into being. Not there at all, and then slowly there, line by line, square by square, tone by tone, emerging. Laura almost whispered these last words and then watched Nora sharply as Nora looked at the shadows and the grades of colour, memorised them as you would memorise words, and then move your breath along them. She went to the piano and played the introduction. Nora knew now to wait until the end of each line to breathe and to follow the tone of the piano, soften and deepen as the keys did, and find a pace from the pace of the playing. Her singing voice now was much deeper than her speaking voice, and this led her towards a greater confidence as she let the voice vibrate darkly on end notes. She knew that she could go higher if she needed to. What she was working on now was tone. Laurie allowed her to change how she sang each time by varying the pace and changing where she softened her playing or left silence. She knew that Laurie was checking regularly to see that she was watching the colours, and she learned to trust Laurie's playing, its tact, its ability to respond. She gazed at the colours made on the paper, the lines, the squares. As she sang, she concentrated hard on one small square of colour. Something began to seep out from it or stirred within the depths of it, something she could see clearly for a second. And then when she blinked and looked back, it had gone. Her mind moved along the lines, the grades of colour, the shades. When the playing stopped and the song had ended, Laurie did not move. Nora stayed still too and kept looking. In the silence of the room, she had a sense for a few seconds of what would happen in time. To her and to Laurie and to the space they were in, it was not that everything would fade or live on and survive in any way. Rather, it struck her how they would all take their turn in the world, shadows within shadows, as Morris had and her mother had done, as all who had come before her had done. As she had just now moved from breath to breath, from one sound to another, from letting her eye gaze into the strangeness which lay between the paint and the paper or within them, before Laurie stood up and said that they could relax now, maybe have tea and listen to something on the stereo. It was only after a month, when she had four or five lessons, that she realized that the music was leading her away from Morris. As they began to work on the German song, sight reading line by line, she saw that this activity was as far away from her life with him and her life with the children as she'd ever imagined. But it was not merely that Morris, like Billy O'Keefe, had no ear for music, and that music was something they had never shared, which pulled her away from him. It was the intensity of her time here. She was alone with herself in a place where he would never have ventured or followed her, even in death. There were days when his having gone seemed part of the past, nothing more than that, and she was grateful, when the lesson ended, that Laurie often did not speak or ask her anything. They both let what happened fill the air of the basement room, echo against the white walls, and do nothing more until the echo faded and Nora went home. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. You're free to linger around the gallery for a